We were last time beginning to look at escape from reason and the God who is there, and Schaefer's sort of general analysis of what has happened in the West in the 20th century. And we started by looking at the line of despair, and I made two introductory comments. The one was that we need to understand our culture in order to communicate to it, otherwise we'll be equipping ourselves to work in a period which no longer exists, or simply talking to ourselves. And secondly, we need to resist the spirit of the age for ourselves, otherwise we will find ourselves washed away by the culture. In another class, some of you remember me quoting T.S. Eliot saying that behavior is as powerful to affect belief, or potent to affect belief, as belief is to affect behavior. If we don't understand our culture and why people live the way they do, we will be washed away simply by conformity to the culture. So the need to resist the spirit of the age. Secondly, in terms of introduction, I made a distinction. The distinction Schaefer makes between rational, or rationality, and rationalism. Now, and then we began to look at the line of despair, what he meant by the line of despair. You'll remember at the end, I started giving you some examples. We looked at Stephen Crane as an example from the end of the 19th century here in the United States, well ahead of the date of 1935 that Schaefer gives. He wasn't suggesting in giving that date there were no individuals before that time, but rather there was a shift in the culture as a whole somewhere around 1935 or so. They're only obviously approximate dates. Another example we might think of from the 19th century in terms of the United States would be Herman Melville, or around the turn of the century, and Moby Dick, where you have, again, a tremendously grim view of life being communicated. From Britain, we looked at one example, and that was those two poems of Thomas Hardy. And I pointed out how early those were written, some point in time probably in the 1860s or so, and how at the time his poetry wasn't popular. But since that time, it's become very popular. His poems read as modern poems, poems that have been very recently written, because they really ring a bell today. At the time, many people didn't understand them. Let's look at one other example from the 19th century, from Britain, and that is the example of Matthew Arnold. If you turn to the things I handed out the other day, if you look at the poem Dover Beach, those of you I've given a copy of this to today, it's the last one on the in these sheets that are stapled together. This is a very famous poem. It is a poem that is repeated over and over again in anthologies of 19th century poetry. That's interesting because Matthew Arnold isn't primarily known as a poet, but rather as an essayist and a commentator on the culture. But this particular poem is known where people will never have heard of Matthew Arnold as a poet. They will know this poem because it summed up very dramatically what was taking place in Britain, and not only in Britain, but throughout the Western world, throughout the world, in the latter part of the 19th century. The poem begins with his listening to the sea withdrawing down the shore as the tide goes out. And already in the first stanza, he is using the sea and its retreat, the going out of the tide, as an image for the sadness of the human condition. You'll notice the last few lines there, starting from line 6 and the end of the first stanza. Listen, you hear the grating roar of pebbles which the waves draw back and fling at their return up the high strand. begin and cease and then again begin with tremulous cadence slow and bring the eternal note of sadness in. Then there's a brief stanza looking back at the ancient Greeks, and how Sophocles has, he suggests, this, who understood this same dilemma of human misery, as he calls it there. But let's note particularly the last two stanzas, where Matthew Arnold expresses where he sees his culture to be. And he's talking about the loss of confidence in Christianity, which he understood very well had shaped the whole of Western civilization. The sea of faith was once too at the full, and round earth's shore lay like the folds of a bright girdle furled. But now I only hear its melancholy long withdrawing roar, retreating to the breath of the night wind and the vast edges drear and naked shingles of the world. Our love, let us be true to one another. For the world, which seems to lie before us like a land of dreams, so various, so beautiful, so new, hath really neither joy, nor love, nor light, nor certitude, nor peace, nor help for pain. And we are here as on a darkling plain, swept with confused alarms of struggle and flight, where ignorant armies clash by night. A very powerful statement of the loss of confidence of a whole culture, the loss of faith, with nothing to replace it. That's already from the latter part of the 19th century. Again, before the date that Schaeffer gives, 1890, but it's really predicts what is happening. And those who were careful observers could see already where the culture all over Europe and the United States was going. Now, those are two examples from Britain, Thomas Hardy and Matthew Arnold, from the 19th century. If we come up to the 20th century, and look, first of all, at a couple of poems. If you think, for example, of the two I've got by Ted Hughes here, as I said the other day, he's the British Poet Laureate at the moment, has published at least half a dozen books of poetry, is very well known not only in England but elsewhere. The two poems I've chosen are both poems which are fairly typical of his writing, A Wind Flashes the Grass and Pibroch. They both start from nature and some distressing scene, one might say, in nature. At least that's certainly how he reads it. The one is a windy day. The other is looking at the sea in Pibroch. But he uses both of them to describe the human condition and the painfulness and misery and absurdity of the human condition. And many of his poems are like this. He's an unusual nature poet in the sense that there is nothing ever sweet or pleasant about his poetry of nature. There's a dramatic change there from, say, poems written around 1800 or even right up until the end of the 19th century, though we see the kind of thing he's doing already in Thomas Hardy. That's perhaps one of the reasons why Hardy was sort of ahead of his time. It was an unusual way to write about nature and use it, nature as an image of the absurdity of the human condition. But this is very common in Hughes' writing. Some of his poems are much more direct, and they just say very bluntly how completely hopeless the human situation is. And perhaps another time I'll bring you one of those. But I think these are actually far more powerful because they communicate to the imagination rather than just a straight statement saying life is meaningless. these will leave you, I think, feeling much sadder if you read them with any kind of sensitivity than the other, because they create images which stay in your mind and then affect the way you look at nature too. But let's look at this one. A wind flashes the grass. Leaves pour blackly across. We cling to the earth with glistening eyes, pierced afresh by the tree's cry. You'll notice he does this all the time. For him, nature takes on, is personified, but it's always personified in terms of expressing the pain of the human condition. And the incomprehensible cry from the boughs and the wind sets us listening for below words, meanings that will not part from the rock. The trees thunder in unison on a gloomy afternoon, and the plowman grows anxious, his tractor becomes terrible, as his memory litters downwind and the shadow of his bones tosses darkly on the air. The trees suddenly storm to a stop in a hush against the sky where the field ends, and crowd there shuddering and wary like horses bewildered by lightning. The stirring of their twigs against the dark travelling sky is the oracle of the earth. They too are afraid, they too are momentary streams, rivers of shadow. If you look at the second one, Pibroch, this is a particularly dramatic poem because of he consciously, repeatedly in his poetry, sets out his position over against Christianity. You'll notice that the two last lines are taken from where? Who recognizes that statement? No, not in those exact words, but... Where does that come from? It's from the book of Job, actually. It talks about all the angels singing and the morning stars shouting together when God created the universe. And you see how, as you read through this, you'll see how Ted Hughes uses that. He knows the Bible very well, and his poems are filled with references to Scripture. The sea cries with its meaningless voice, treating alike its dead and its living. Probably bored with the appearance of heaven after so many millions of nights without sleep, without purpose, without self-deception. Stone likewise. A pebble is imprisoned like nothing in the universe, created for black sleep or growing conscious of the sun's red spot occasionally, then dreaming it is the fetus of God. Over the stone rushes the wind, able to mingle with nothing, like the hearing of the blind stone itself, or turns as if the stone's mind came feeling a fantasy of directions. Drinking the sea and eating the rock, a tree struggles to make leaves. An old woman fallen from space, unprepared for these conditions. She hangs on because her mind's gone completely. Minute after minute, aeon after aeon, nothing lets up or develops. And this is neither a bad variant nor a triad. This is where the staring angels go through. This is where all the stars bow down. Very powerful way to finish them. And you notice he says in the second to last stanza there, he uses this tree to describe again the human condition and says the only reason that she hangs on in the struggle for life is because her mind's gone. Nobody who wasn't insane would continue to try, except those who are insane would continue to try to exist at all. That's really what he's saying. Now that's an example from Britain today. Let me turn to a different kind of one, and that's the first one you've got there, those I handed out today, and that's Alice's Adventures in Wonderland. Not the new sheets I handed out today, but for those of you who weren't here the other day. But this is from a British newspaper last Christmas from The Independent, which is a daily newspaper in Britain. This article is describing not just modern philosophy with its loss of believing that truth can be found, but the way that has influenced every area. And let me just read it to you. It's a very fine expression of the dilemma of our culture, of what Schaefer means by people being below the line of despair. In Alice's Adventures in Wonderland, the Dodo introduces Alice to the notion of a caucus race. He marks out some space with no particular shape. Various creatures stand around in it, here and there, and in quite random fashion some of them run about. There was no 1, 2, 3 and away, but they began when they liked and left off when they liked, so it was not easy to know when the race was over. It is an irrational way to run a race with no center, no rules, no authority, and no purpose. The Dodo decides that as there are no criteria by which he can choose a winner, they may as well all be winners. But that decision, too, is arbitrary. They might just as well be losers. The very concepts winners and losers seem a matter of convention dictated by the Dodo's whim. Now, I think Lewis Carroll actually intended this when he wrote this account of the caucus race in Alice in Wonderland to be a description already of where our culture was heading. Alice in Wonderland and Alice Through the Looking Glass are brilliant books. They can be read simply as children's stories, but they can be read at another level as well. Lewis Carroll knew very well what he was doing when he described this caucus race. Now, the author here of this article uses this as a metaphor for where our culture is. The caucus race is an apt metaphor for the postmodern, a style of thinking in which there are no winners or losers, but only unrooted conventions. All equally valid, or invalid, because of course once you've said things are all equally valid, you might just as well say they're equally invalid, because the whole concept of validity has disappeared. And all equally devoid of meaning. It is a style which has undermined sound common sense in nearly every field of contemporary culture. The philosophy is one of despair, and it is rooted in the deeply nihilistic trend within professional philosophy. It is only through understanding the nature of this trend that we can fully appreciate its sweeping implications. And then here's the comment, and this is what Schaefer is getting at when he talks about the way our whole culture has changed, what he calls the shift in modern thought. There are no such things as truth or goodness, and philosophers who search for them are in error. Every value is equal to every other value. Nothing is real or natural or authoritative. Everything is up for interpretation. Goodness, God, literary meaning or merit, artistic or architectural standards, even gender. Though called variously deconstructionists, post-structuralists, pragmatists, or simply nihilists, together the new anti-philosophers have defined the characteristic postmodern style of thinking. The modern against which they are pitted, and this is again, you see, the point that Schaefer was making, the way the whole history of thought since the Enlightenment in the West has been turned on its head by what he calls the coming of the line of despair, or the change in the way of thinking. The modern against which they are pitted is the humanist framework of the Enlightenment. Though humanism itself denied there were any God-given foundations for eternal truth and value, it did believe passionately in the universal capacity of reason to illuminate and determine all problems. And the Enlightenment faith in the perfectibility of man led to a wholehearted belief in progress. The anti-philosophers denied both. Now remember, Schaefer used the image of philosophy up until this period, which is called postmodern in this article. While it didn't necessarily have all the answers, philosophers believed that there were answers to be found. That simply starting from the human person, and this is where this article is talking about the Enlightenment, simply starting from the human person with the aid of reason, we would be able to find all the answers to the questions face us. So a tremendous confidence in the power of reason. At the same time, as he points out here, a confidence in the human person, that people will get better and that society will get better, that there will be real progress. What has happened, and now that we, as Schaefer says, are under the line of despair, is that there is both a loss in the power of reason, a loss in the goodness of man, and a loss in the possibility of progress. And it's really impossible to understand our culture unless we really see that that's where so many people are. That is the whole drift of the culture in which we live. Let's turn and look at another example from the States today. This one isn't there. We looked at the article from the Post-Dispatch the other day where we were looking at the loss of truth. What's true for one person is quite different for somebody else. Just as this article says, the daddy and his faith, if you remember that one, daddy who is God, a father is humbled, really is saying, well, people all believe different things, and what's important is that it's valid for you at your age or who you are or with the problems that you face. Not a question of truth at all. One of the examples I was thinking of here was the example of Woody Allen and his film Crimes and Misdemeanors, where, if you remember that film, and how many of you have seen it? Crimes and Misdemeanors. Good, I keep encouraging people to see it. Eventually everybody gets to go and see it. But I would encourage you to see it. Get it out from a video store and watch it, because it is a very sensitive exploration of our dilemma today, the dilemma of our culture, and of the loss of meaning. I mean, that is really the theme of the film. You remember that Woody Allen's hero in the film is this philosopher who eventually commits suicide. He looks to him as the person who's got the answers to life, and then he kills himself because he discovers he hasn't got any answers at all. You know, in Schaeffer's terms, the hero in the film is below the line of despair. He finds no answers, ultimately. Another film I remember seeing several years ago, and again, I'd encourage you to see it if you can get hold of it. This is a foreign film, so it's not so easy to get hold of. I think it may be Spanish. Is The Exterminating Angel. Any of you have seen that? The Exterminating Angel? It's an amazing film. If you already feel depressed, don't go and see it. Wait until you're going fairly together and take a friend when you go. Make sure you discuss it afterwards. The film starts in a concert, and purposely there's this wonderful classical concert. Somebody with a piano, playing the piano, great musicians, violin and cello, and all these very beautifully dressed society people coming together into this beautiful room. I mean, it's really lovely. I mean, it's just the images of the wonderful things that civilization has produced, that Western civilization has produced. And there are these people, tremendously good-mannered, polite, courteous, respectable people, you know, with absolutely everything going for them. Money, art, artistic, you know, just they've got everything. Good looks, power in the society, and so on. And then suddenly, they're in the middle of this party, listening to this concert, and they find they can't get out of the room. I mean, the door is open, but they just can't get out. They are just stuck in the room. And you see their lives gradually falling apart as they realize that there is no exit at all. That's really the theme, that there is no exit. That's the title of one of Sartre's plays. But there is no exit from their life. They are stuck in this room, and you see everything breaking down. They make a fire with the musical instruments, these beautiful musical instruments. They start being incredibly rude to one another. The facade of culture just completely disappears. It's rather like Lord of the Flies, except these are sophisticated adults rather than children whose lives are falling apart. And, you know, some of them die. I mean, it's really appalling. And he's obviously using it as an image of the human condition. You know, we are trapped in a situation which makes no sense and from which there is no escape. Well, then suddenly they're able to get out of the room. And then the last scene of the film, and this is the most dramatic part of the film, they are in a church, and you can imagine what's coming. They're in a church having a memorial service for the people who died while they're in the room. And then suddenly, at the end of the film, they can't get out of the church. You know, and they're all there, the priest and the choir and all of these people, town dignitaries, and so on. And that's where you're left. You know, and the point is, I mean, it's a very powerful statement, the church doesn't have any answers either. The church has no answers either. That's the theme of Ferlinghetti's poem, which I gave you to read as well. We won't read that one now, but if you look at it in your leisure, perhaps I shouldn't say in your leisure, in your work, this is from Lawrence Ferlinghetti, Sometime During Eternity. That's a poem about Christ, and he's just saying quite simply, we no longer believe that he has any answers to the dilemma either. He's dead. That's how he finishes. He's real dead. There is no resurrection. There's no hope from there either. Now, what we might say as we think about the line of despair, that what is involved, what Schaeffer is saying is, as we look at our culture, is that there's a loss of truth. We cannot find truth any longer. There is no truth to be found. And even no objective knowledge. That the only things we can know are subjectively apprehended. Perception is reality. That is where our culture is. The second is a loss of moral certainty. There are no objective moral values. There is simply personal choice. I had lunch with Chris today, and he was quoting some opinion poll he saw, which said 70% of the American people believe that abortion is wrong, but the great majority of those think that people should choose what they do at the same time. You know, so even where people say that they have moral values, that they think that certain moral values stand, they don't carry it through, because this belief that in the end morals are purely personal is even more fundamental in our culture. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a very good example. What is taught for morality in most schools now is what's called values clarification, where in fact what is done, I mean, the idea is the child should be taught how to learn to make their own moral decisions. But what they actually do is choose impossibly difficult moral situations to give to little children to try and figure out. And it really creates you've got several things happening. One is, since we as adults are not going to tell you what is right and wrong, you have to decide for yourself. I mean, that is the strongest thing that's coming across. And even beyond that, because they choose such awfully difficult circumstances, impossible situations which are difficult for anybody to deal with, where you don't feel there are easy answers, the child ends up with a feeling that moral certainty is something that simply can't be had anyway. That you might do this, but you might do something else. And it's very destructive, actually, because it really puts kids in the position of thinking, well, it doesn't matter what other people say. In actual fact, there are no moral certainties at all. So that's the second, the loss of moral certainty. The third is a loss of meaning to history. Are we going anywhere? And there's a profound skepticism about that. I think just one illustration of that is if you think about the way a few years ago there was such a strong sense of doom about the possibility of the nuclear winter, of an all-out nuclear war. And you might say, well, in one sense, that's reasonable. But if there was any confidence whatsoever in the culture that there is a God who rules over history, because most of the people who had that sense of doom would have said at the same time they believed in God, if there's any sense at all of confidence in a God who rules history, you know that's not how history is going to end. But the fear of nuclear disaster fed right into that sense of uncertainty about the future, which is a fundamental part of our culture. The fourth consequence of this is the loss of purpose for the individual. What am I here for? Is there really any transcendent purpose to my life, which gives me and my life as an individual meaning? And of course, what that leads to practically is just all sorts of practical idolatry of money and pleasure and sex and drugs and everything else. Those are four of the consequences of what Schaefer is speaking about here, that now our culture is below the line of despair. Now, before we move on to the next point, I want to move to what he has to say about the upper and lower story. Does anybody have any questions here, just on this section? I mean, we could multiply thousands of examples. I've just given you a few here. But we could multiply so many examples of the expression of this despair.
I think I'm getting the upper and lower stories mixed up with the line of despair.
Okay, well, we're just coming to that. What does Schaefer mean by the upper and lower story? Why it's confusing is because he uses a similar diagram for both. And we've got a line across, but don't think about it as the same line as before. That's where it's confusing. This isn't the line of despair now. This is the line dividing what he calls the upper story and the lower story. What he means is that what he's dealing with now is the question, how do people cope with the fact that they're living below the line of despair, as he expresses it? How do people cope now that we are in a culture which has lost its confidence that truth can be found, that moral certainty can be found, that there is a meaning to history, that there is purpose for the individual? How do we cope with skepticism and relativism, in other words? And he suggests that how we cope now is by making a radical division between reason and faith. And I'll explain what he means. In what he calls the lower story, in the area of reason, of the rational, that is, of trying to think objectively and carefully about life, about what we face, about what we're going to do, that in the area of reason, of the rational, reason leads us only to pessimism. It puts us below the line of despair, going back to the first main point we were speaking about. Reason leads us to pessimism. If we think rationally about the human condition, we will come up with no answers at all. We will be driven to what's called in that article postmodernism. There are no objective values. There is no truth to be found. One thing, one opinion is just as valid or invalid as another. So we're just left in a hopeless situation. How do we cope? Well, we cope with faith, with some kind of non-rational answer, and this is the only way to have optimism. In other words, we won't ever, by reason, by reflecting on our situation rationally, come up with an answer which gives us any hope. The only way we'll have any hope is by a completely irrational leap. Now, we may put... I'll give you an illustration in a minute which will help you to understand what this means. But we may put up here in what he calls the upper story some kind of existential experience. If you've read any Hemingway, who's read any Hemingway? Okay, what's Hemingway's existential experience that gives meaning to life? Well, sex, mostly.
Part of it, I guess.
Well, that's part of it. That's exactly right. But it's mostly just sex, yeah. That's, or the macho experience. That's right. I mean, becoming a bullfighter or fighting against nature. Let me just use one example here before we go on, and to help us understand what we're speaking about. If you look at Sylvia Plath's example, Black Rook in Rainy Weather. For those who I handed this out to today, it's the second sheet, and it's missing its title. Sylvia Plath, you remember, spelt with an A-T-H, was an American writer who was actually married to Ted Hughes, the writer of those other couple of poems we looked at. Married to him for a while. Now, I'm going to read this poem right through, but I want you to notice here how she contrasts in this poem what can be rationally understood, what one has on the basis of reason, one might say, on the basis of thinking logically about life, and what Schaefer calls here an existential experience. In the poem, the existential experience for her comes from seeing a rook arranging its feathers in the rain. Now, as a Christian, one can say, well, that's great, because, as Paul says in Romans 1, the invisible things of God, his eternal power and divine nature, are clearly perceived in the things that are made. So when somebody looks at nature and it gives them some kind of hope, some kind of experience of meaning, you can say, well, in a way, that's good. But for somebody like her, who doesn't have any basis for that, who doesn't have any belief in God at all, it's a completely irrational experience. It's not something she can predict. It's not something she can produce. She just hopes that it may happen from time to time. Let's listen to this poem. On the stiff twig up there hunches a wet black rook, arranging and rearranging its feathers in the rain. I do not expect a miracle or an accident to set the sight on fire in my eye, nor seek any more in the desultory weather some design. But let spotted leaves fall as they fall, without ceremony or portent. Although I admit I desire occasionally some back talk from the mute sky, I can't honestly complain. A certain minor light may still leap incandescent out of a kitchen table or chair, as if a celestial burning took possession of the most obtuse objects now and then, thus hallowing an interval otherwise inconsequent by bestowing largesse, honour, one might say love. At any rate, I now walk wary, for it could happen even in this dull, ruinous landscape. Sceptical, yet politic, ignorant of whatever angel may choose to flare suddenly at my elbow, I only know that a rook ordering its black feathers can so shine as to seize my senses, haul my eyelids up, and grant a brief respite from fear of total neutrality. With luck, trekking stubborn through this season of fatigue, I shall patch together a content of sorts. Miracles occur, if you care to call those spasmodic tricks of radiance miracles. The wait's begun again. The long wait for the angel, for that rare, random descent. Now, Sylvia Plath captures in that poem exactly what existentialism is speaking about, if you've read any existentialist literature. That there are these events or moments in one's life where suddenly one is invested with a sense that life has some kind of meaning, even though rationally you know it has no meaning at all. That's what Schaefer is speaking about here. On the level of reason, you know that the sky is mute. That is, that it has nothing to say. There is no voice from heaven to us. You know rationally that this is a dull, ruinous landscape, as she expresses it, or a season of fatigue, or that it leads one to total neutrality, as she puts it that way, to the loss, that is, of everything human in us and hopeful. Rationally, that's where we are led. But one has to live in hope, but with no confidence, not hope in the biblical sense at all, which has a surety of something happening in the future when God comes in Christ. no hope in that sense at all, but a hope against hope, because it's random, it's rare, and you know that it's not anything real. You notice her words here, those spasmodic tricks of radiance. She knows that that is not telling us anything real about reality. It's just something which enables her to keep on coping for a while. She can't expect it. She knows she needs it. And she can't live without it. And as I mentioned the other day, in fact, she did commit suicide. In the end, she tried to commit suicide many, many times before she finally succeeded. But this poem expresses perfectly what Schaefer is speaking about here. And now there are all kinds of things that you may put in this area. You may put drugs here. You may put sex here. You may put relationships. Though for many people, those are increasingly very temporary, rather than any kind of permanent thing. Because if you put your whole hope in a relationship without anything solid to build it on, well, then it won't survive, because it's like a kind of idol which destroys itself. People put their hope in anything without any kind of rational basis for doing so. What's astonishing is that people will even put their hope in the occult. People who may appear to be total rationalists, you will suddenly find playing occult games. If you discuss with them at a rational level, they will tell you that we're living in a completely material universe. This happened with a lot of my friends at high school and university, all those years ago that I was in high school and university. I mean, we're all taught to be rationalists by our educational system. But lots of people played with occult things, and you don't even think about trying to put the two together. It's in a completely other area, and if you stop to reflect about it, you'll say, no, I don't believe in that. And yet you would play these games, and real things would take place, and they'd give you a kind of kick. So you might even put the occult in here. Now, I would say much of the growth of the New Age movement fits in here absolutely. You've got people who, at the level of reason, would say there are only grounds for pessimism. If you read Shirley MacLaine, I mean, this is really what she has to say. In fact, what she says is you cannot trust your reason any longer. And this is the answer the New Age gives, because reason does only lead us to pessimism, because it doesn't give us any meaning or hope. We have to put our hope in a completely different area. And that area is increasingly different kinds of New Age thinking.